I hope you all had a beautiful Hanukkah and ate as many latkes and donuts as you were able. We have a big show today, so I'm going to keep this intro short because I'm mostly just excited for you to hear from today's guest, Kelly Bulkley, who earned his PhD in Religion and Psychological Studies from the University of Chicago, a Master's in Theological Studies from Harvard, and a BA from Stanford. Not bad. He is the director of the Sleep and Dream Database, which I'll let him explain in further detail, and he's also the author of many brilliant books, including Dreaming in the World's Religions, A Comparative History, Big Dreams, The Science of Dreaming and the Origins of Religion, and American Dreamers, What Dreams Tell Us About the Political Psychology of Conservatives, Liberals, and Everyone Else. Needless to say, we've got a lot of questions, and he's got a lot of answers. These are the kinds of conversations I'm so excited to have here on the show. Conversations where we invite passionate thinkers from varied fields to use their expertise to reveal aspects of the Torah portion that we could never have imagined ourselves. We're nearing the end of Genesis, and while we've learned so much already, we've got so much more to go. And I can't wait. So, without further ado, I'm Raviv Ullman, and welcome to the study. Today we are talking dreams, and I couldn't be more excited to welcome Kelly Bulkley to the show. Thanks for joining.
Oh, glad to be here. Thank you.
Kelly, would you mind introducing yourself and telling our listeners a bit about your professional background, considering that you've literally written the book on today's subject?
Well, thank you. I'm a dream researcher. I study dreams from a religious and psychological perspective. My academic training is in religious studies, the psychology of religion, not because I'm approaching dreams from one or another particular religious perspective, but because I'm so interested in dreams. And prior to the emergence of psychology as a discipline a couple hundred years ago, the main arena in which humans explored their dreams and discussed them and tried to understand what they mean is in religion. And so to study dreams meant, I felt, to study world religion. So that's what I did academically. And since then, I've been teaching. I write a lot, participate both in religious studies conversations and psychology conversations, kind of religion science topics, with dreams as kind of my bridging phenomenon. And so I have lots of interest, anything to do with dreams, art, history, science. And I guess I'll stop with just most recently, I've been doing a lot of work with dreams and digital technologies of linguistic analysis and trying to discern bigger patterns in dreams when they are aggregated and digitized and turned into zeros and ones, you know, what we can find that way.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time for us today. Rabbi Adam, Kelly wrote to us that this parsha includes, I'll quote your email, Kelly, one of the most fraught and consequential dream discussions in Western history. So with that in mind, and no pressure, could you give us the rundown of this week's Parsha Miketz?
Oh my God, Kelly, this is going to be amazing. I am so grateful to you for joining us, and I feel like I am going to learn so much over the course of the next hour. So just a quick rundown of Parsha Miketz. This is the 10th Parsha in the Torah. Raviv, we have been at this for 10 weeks. Can you
Not
believe
bad.
It?
Not bad. We made it this far.
Time has flown. And also, it's still 2020, so time is still standing still. Where we left off last week, Joseph, the son of Jacob, one of Jacob's 12 sons, has been sold into slavery by his brothers in Egypt. He was sold to a man named Potiphar. Potiphar's wife made a sexual advance on Joseph, says the story. And when Joseph resists that, she accuses him of rape. And Potiphar turns him over to the authorities. And Joseph is cast down into the dungeon. The trajectory of last week's Parsha is a trajectory of descent. Joseph goes from the most favored child down into the pit, down into Egypt, down into the dungeon. And this week's Parsha is going to be a reversal of that direction. He is going to come up out of the dungeons, and not only is he going to go back to just being a regular Canaanite boy, he's actually going to rise to be the number two in Egypt, essentially the prime minister of Egypt. It's a pretty amazing story of down to the lowest depths and up to the highest heights. And it all takes place because of dreams. So Joseph gets into trouble with his brothers. In addition for being a bit of a tattletale to their father, he gets into trouble with them because he tells them about these dreams in which bales of wheat and stars, the sun, the moon, and the stars, all gather and bow down to him. And the brothers understand this dream to be a dream of Joseph claiming superiority over them, that they will all someday bow to him, and they're going to show him. They throw him down into a pit and sell him into slavery. Ha ha ha. Joseph, in the dungeon of Egypt, starts interpreting the dreams of two of Pharaoh's former courtiers who had fallen clearly into disfavor because they were in the dungeon, a baker and a cupbearer. He tells the cupbearer that he will be restored. He tells the baker that he will be executed. And that's where last week's Parsha ends. Pharaoh, at the beginning of this week's Parsha, is having a series of troubling dreams. And we'll really dig into what those dreams are, but dreams of seven fat cows and seven lean cows, seven fat ears of corn and seven shriveled up ears of corn, all emerging out of the Nile. He's having these dreams night after night, and none of his dream interpreters, his magicians, his priests can explain to him. He gets word that there is this prisoner down in the dungeons who seems to have a special talent for dream interpretation, and Joseph is dragged up from the depths into the throne room, and Pharaoh demands an explanation for his dreams. Joseph explains that the dreams mean that while Egypt is fated to have 7 years of plenty, they'll be followed by 7 years of famine, and so Pharaoh would do well to impose a new system of taxation to put aside additional grain right now for the lean times to come. Pharaoh thinks this is a very good idea and not only thanks Joseph for his services, but promotes Joseph, as I said, to this high, high office to be in charge of the collection and then the distribution of grain. What's going to happen next in the story is that some years pass and this group of scraggly Canaanites make their way to Egypt. There is a famine in Canaan, and they come in and have a meeting with the Pharaoh's prime minister, hoping to buy grain. Who do these Canaanite men turn out to be? None other than Joseph's brothers who sold him into slavery. And Joseph engages in this whole series of tests to try to see, his brothers don't recognize him, to try to see if the brothers have reformed their ways. If they're still the same men who threw him into a pit and sent him off to Egypt and told their father that he was dead. And he engages in quite a lot of trickery, insisting that they leave behind a hostage and go back to their father and bring back Joseph's only full brother, the youngest of Jacob's sons, Benjamin, when they relent and do that. He invites them to a feast and tucks a goblet into Benjamin's bag, which will then be found on the way out of the feast. And Joseph will say, I'm going to take this one as my slave. And the test will be to see whether the brothers will give up yet another of their siblings to Egyptian slavery or whether they'll step up. The question is left unanswered at the end of this Parsha. I say this every single time we meet. There's a lot going on here between the dreams and this trajectory of Joseph and this interrogation of the brothers. I think we're going to have a great deal to talk about.
I'd love to back up a little bit. And Kelly, because we're talking about dreams today, wondering if you could orient or perhaps disorient us with your science-based hypothesis on what dreams are and why we dream. I mean, what the heck are dreams?
Yeah. Well, dreams at one level are mental activity during sleep. And so when we go to sleep, our brains don't just shut down until we wake up when they turn back on. during sleep, the brain mind system goes through regular cycles of activation. Different parts of the brain turn on, others turn off, different combinations. And during certain phases, what we call rapid eye movement sleep or paradoxical sleep, that's another term for these phases, the brain becomes extremely activated, as intensely activated in neuroelectrical terms as our brains are while we're wide awake. So 3, 4, 5 times during the night for between 10 to 60 minutes, our brains rev up to what we in waking life would consider kind of full speed, full power. What's happening during those phases? Well, those seem to be phases when dreaming is most likely to occur. So the fact that those REM phases, that the cycle of REM sleep through the course of the night is hardwired into not only every human, but into all mammals and many avian species as well, birds as well, suggests that whatever is going on is deeply, deeply rooted in the evolutionary heritage of our species. So all the way is saying that whatever is going on in these highly aroused phases of the sleep cycle, which are very metabolically expensive, it takes up a lot of energy. That's you know, nature is very prudent about energy expenditure. So the fact that this organismic process has endured through evolutionary history, despite taking up a lot of metabolic energy, suggests there's something important happening there, something very valuable. So that at sort of a scientific level suggests that dreaming is, we are a dreaming species, that is just innate in who we are as a species. Add to that psychological research, how often do people remember their dreams? There's maybe 1% of the population that seems to truly, truly never, ever, ever remember their dreams. It seems that basically 99% of the population remembers at least some dreams, at least at some point during their lives. And probably the overall average is about one dream recalled a week or so. That seems to be kind of the median, but about half the population once a week or more dream recall, about half the population once a week or less. That seems to be kind of the typical human breakout. So dreaming is just part of human experience at that level.
I'm wondering, if we rewind to origins that precede modern science, in your book, Dreaming in the World's Religions, you mentioned that a line from the Brachot, a tractate from Talmud, a dream which is not interpreted is like a letter which is not read, suggests a religious obligation to heed the divine messages conveyed by dreams.
Right. And that passage, in another sense, signals a perennial human question about dreaming, which is, where ultimately do dreams come from? And to suggest that a dream is a letter or a message that's unread suggests there's a sender, and that the dreamer is the recipient. And that indeed is historically a very widespread belief, that dreams come from otherworldly, suprahuman type beings and realities, that we are the recipient of dreams coming in that way. Other people, and not just modern people, but even and we could talk about this in the Bible, in various passages in the text that we can talk about, there's skepticism about dreams. Maybe dreams are just kind of the nonsense of your own brain. Maybe they're just passing thoughts that are just flitting through your sleep-addled mind. So there's a perennial tension around this question of, where do dreams come from? And so the saying that a dream is like an unopened letter, so to that effect, is kind of taking the side that yes, there is something, there's a signal there. It's not just noise. There is actually some content, some meaning that is being sent to the waking self.
Could you give us a brief history of the role that dreams and their interpretations have played in the Abrahamic religions, including the role that Joseph plays in that history?
Telling you that story, kind of from the Joseph being imprisoned all the way through to the end there, that was a beautiful rendition. And it really, as a story, it actually, I think, does make more sense when considered in relation to the other dream phenomena that have already happened in Genesis up until that point. and the broader Mesopotamian context. What's going on in that world, the world in which these early Jews were living, and how they thought about dreams. And going back millennia, in some cases, there were traditions with ancient Sumerians and Akkadians and Babylonians and Hittites leading up to the Egyptians of recognizing that dreams can be powerful divine revelations. There's a long history of that in that part of the world, the Epic of Gilgamesh being one of the sort of the best preserved and clearest examples. There are several fascinating dream episodes, nightmare episodes in the Epic of Gilgamesh that show some of the beliefs that were current at that time, foremost of which was God or the gods speak to people at the top of the pyramid of power, shall we say. They talk to kings, they talk to priests, they talk to military leaders, right? All the records that we have through these times, and of course, presumably ordinary people were dreaming too, but the cultural attention to dreaming was focused on the dreams of the great leaders. Along with that, there's a belief that almost you could say a transactional view of it, that dreams were politically legitimating, that they could predict the future, and thus the king, the military leader, could perform certain rituals, certain practices and prayers that would generate a dream in response. We today call that a dream incubation ritual. And these rituals were practiced widely as a way of eliciting a divine dream response. Okay, so all of that is the context for then in the Jewish context, starting with Abraham, and then Jacob. I'm assuming you guys have read through this. These are not kings, right? These are not great military leaders. These are ordinary people whom Yahweh, whom God, is treating like a Mesopotamian king in bestowing these magnificent dream revelations, the visions that Abraham and Jacob see, the heavenly ladder, and these cosmic promises of prosperity and future well-being. This is truly the stuff of earlier ancient Near Eastern monarchs. And here we see it happening in to these other, these people who are oppressed. Not only are they not at the top of the pyramid, they're way down. And so, this leading up to Joseph's story, he's about as low as you can get, right? His brothers have cast him into the pit, the cave, wherever they dump him, with words that I take personally in a way, because he's being spurned and scorned because of his interest in dreams, because he takes dreams seriously. The cruelty is specific to, we're going to throw you in the pit and show you that your dreams come to nothing. We're going to make your dreams nothing. I haven't been cast in a pit, fortunately, but the contemporary world is not super friendly to dreamers, shall we say, to people who study dreams even. And so I feel it with Joseph in that moment. And so then what happens? He finds himself in prison. This again is we now recognize a classic theme at the prisoner's dream, people who are captive physically, their imaginations roaming beyond their physical space, hoping for something beyond. Here, Joseph meets the butler, he meets the baker of the Pharaoh, and what do you know? They're having troubling dreams. And what Joseph is able to do is his interpretive, he right off says, well, dreams belong to God, right? And the interpretation of dreams belong to God. So it isn't me doing this. It's not my skill. It's not my priestly training. God will help us out. And as you said, there's the interpretation where, the butler, hey, three bunches of grapes, that means in 3 days you're going to be back in service to the Pharaoh. Baker, sorry, three crows, I think it's eating loaves of bread off your head. You're going to die in 3 days. What do you know? That object to time metaphor that he applies in his interpretation comes to pass. Butler is released, baker is executed. And it's the butler who tells the Pharaoh, hey, Pharaoh, you had these troubling dreams. I met this guy in prison, Joseph. He might be able to help. And so, again, there's what I think is distinctive about the way the Jewish dream interpretation kind of emerges from this encounter. That's why I say it's such a fraught and consequential encounter, is precisely that we have someone coming from the lowest of the low without the traditional training, without the traditional power and such, and yet being able to interpret the dreams that the Pharaoh has had that none of the other wise advisors, sages, diviners, etc. have been able to interpret. So there's this just magnificent, indeed, I would say revolutionary inversion of the power of dream interpretation from the classic ancient Near Eastern wise man to the pure and pious and faithful young man, in this case, Joseph. And just parenthetically, you know, the Bible, the Hebrew Bible, the whole shebang, there are many stories. And so Joseph's story is just one. So this moment is so interesting because it's such a complete reversal of the usual dynamics of dream interpretation.
I think that's so cool to think about it from a revolutionary standpoint in history and storytelling. And dream interpretation as obligation. Rabbi Adam, do you agree with that? Is there within Judaism an obligation to interpret dreams, to not leave these letters unread?
There is a multivocal response to the question of our dreams messages in the tradition. You know, pages of Talmud are just made up of arguments back and forth that very rarely come to any definitive resolution. In fact, 99% of the discussions in the Talmud are left with Rabbi A says this, Rabbi B says that, Rabbi C says right. Neither of you know what you're talking about, and are left unresolved.
Right.
So there are voices on the page that say dreams are absolutely messages from the divine. There are voices that say dreams are entirely the mixed up contents of your mind. And then there's a sort of third way tradition, which I have always liked, which is a line that gets repeated a few times in the Talmud, and I'm curious, Kelly, your response to this, that a dream is 1/60th of a prophecy.
Right?
So what does 1/60th of a prophecy mean? It means most of it is nonsense, and there is a kernel in every dream that has something profound to teach. I'm wondering your response to that idea.
Yeah, well, there's certainly a continuity in with Jewish dream teachings and the other Egyptian, Babylonian, etc. traditions of considering dreams as anticipations of the future, and particularly around phenomena that are of survival interest and issues. And so again, with Joseph and the Pharaoh, it's not just Pharaoh dreaming about, you know, he stubbed his toe yesterday. No, he's dreaming about in some ways, it's an environmental crisis dream. I mean, I've spoken with some friends who've looked at this as one of the earliest sort of environmental warning sign dreams where, hey, a dream can signal a drought and a famine. And if we pay attention to our dreams, we might be able to anticipate these things and see them coming. That idea of dreaming as having prophetic, mantic significance is not exclusive to Judaism, but it certainly is part of the interest. And yet, and maybe this is somewhat distinctive of Judaism, that it recognizes a hierarchy of, Moses puts it in terms of a hierarchy. You know, there's dark speech like dreams, and then there's the clear, direct, face-to-face vision, you know, however Moses phrased it. You guys have to help me if I get things wrong here, but that Moses is an early exponent of this idea that yes, dreaming is something. It's not nothing, but it's not as good as it can be, and that does distinguish, I think, Judaism. That the early patriarchs were claiming a more direct, immediate relation with the one God than was found in other cultures and religions at that time. I mean, there's some examples, like I won't be able to quote them right off, but in the various parts of the Hebrew Bible where other people's dreams are significant, that you can overhear, you know, I think there's a Midianite soldier, I think, talks about a dream, and somebody overhears it. It's like, whoa, that's interesting. Like, the Jews, I think, are at this time, through a saying like that, realizing like, hey, not only are all people potentially dreamers, Joseph, Jacob, Abraham, all of us, but every dream perhaps has some potential divine significance.
It reminds me, there's a story that I love in the Book of Numbers about Moses gathering up chieftains from all of the different tribes, and they're all supposed to come together in the tent of meeting and there receive some sort of revelation from God. But there are two of the elders who don't make it to the party, Eldad and Medad. They are outside of the authorized space for receiving the Spirit of God, and yet they get this revelation, dream, vision, and they start prophesying outside of the authorized tent. And people come to Moses and say, stop them. They're unauthorized prophets. And Moses' response is, would that all of God's people were prophets. This idea that I'm really loving this idea of democratizing who can receive revelation. From the Mesopotamian stories in which it needs to be the king, to Jacob on the run from his brother, or Joseph down in the pit, to this line from Moses, I wish everybody had this capacity. And then also some traditions that lean in the other direction, that say, no, there are authoritative revelations and then there are nonsense revelations. And those two things feel like they're in conflict with each other.
Yeah. Because if once you open the door to dreaming, you open the door to dreaming, and it's, going back to some of the scientific research, the signal, signature aspect of dreaming is the sense that it comes not from my waking ego self, but from some other part of the mind. And when we talk with really scientific researchers about, well, how far back does that go, that sort of unconscious, autonomous, dream-generating capacity? Again, I'm trained as a religious studies scholar, ultimately, and we really start to get into, ultimately, I think, kind of philosophical or theological types of conversations about what are the ultimate sources of our dreams. And so this is a question that modern science is not solved either. And so it throws it back, ultimately, I would say, on the dreamer and his or her community to cultivate standards that are helpful and pragmatic. I guess I think one of you guys were raising a question about what are the epistemological standards we use in trying to discern helpful, potentially prophetic dreams from nonsensical, potentially misleading dreams. I mean, that's an important thing. If you don't want to have a false positive or a false negative, right? You don't want to miss a divine revelation, but you don't want to treat nonsense as a divine revelation, right? So if you really believe in the divine potential of dreams, you are kind of stuck with this. And so I would say, actually, the Jewish tradition, the kind of Talmudic tradition of commentary, is actually a kind of a beautiful way of elaborating on that tension, not dissolving it in one side or the other, but living with it and helping people kind of navigate their way through it.
When it comes to dreams, it doesn't sound like there's anything like consensus, but is there a leaning in the scholarly world, both neurologists and the scientists, and also, in the psychological and psychiatric communities, about what percentage of a dream is meaningful, what percentage of a dream is noise? Is there anything like a consensus?
That's where the some of the newer digital technologies are becoming useful, because what those technologies can do is take, if, and it's a big if, we gather large enough sets of high quality dream reports from different sources that we trust, people aren't just making them up, or we have a good high quality data set, we can do various kind of simple word search type processes, topic modeling, different kinds of things that highlight patterns in the word usage. And what we're finding is in ways that are I think about as objective as just about anything can be, in terms of like you can see it for yourself. Patterns of dream content accurately reflect people's most important emotional concerns in waking life, particularly their relationships. And so those, I would say, in terms of this kind of signal noise metaphor, those are the strongest signals in dream content, that they reflect our major emotional concerns in waking life, particularly around our social lives, our social relations, family, friends, and whatnot. It's not to say there aren't other elements and dimensions of meaning. There are, but the ones that these tools are able to show us with I think, really impressive clarity. And what I mean by that is, let's create a little experiment. I could give you each four sets of 100 dreams each from somebody you don't know anything about. And all you have for each of those four sets are percentages of how often they use vision words, smell words, hearing words, fear, happiness, sadness, transportation, family, you know, a list. I've got a template for this. And just those percentages, you can say, oh, well, that person's a war veteran. That's a young woman college student who plays soccer. Huh, I think that guy's a newspaper reporter. And huh, that's a woman who's got, you know, a husband who's got some sort of illness, right? And you'd be right. And if we, right, because the patterns of dream content are accurate reflections of these kinds of phenomena. Again, not the only thing. In some ways, we're like, duh, like you could just ask the person and they'd tell you in a second that's what's going on. But the point is that's really, to me, convincing evidence that there is some dimension of meaning, of objective personal meaning in dream content as it relates to people's lives. Part of the reason I'm so excited about that research is it kind of takes away any scientific foundation for the idea that dreams are just random nonsense. People can claim that on kind of philosophical grounds or other grounds, but they can no longer claim that on empirical scientific grounds, because the evidence just shows the opposite.
And I feel a little bit silly for asking this, and maybe this is outside of the realm of science, but I can't help, you know, the dreams that Joseph is talking about are all predictive dreams. There will be 7 years of plenty and 7 years of famine. Is there any empirical evidence at all for precognitive ability in dreams, for dreams indicating something which is to come?
Yes, and actually I've gotten very wealthy by using my dreams to predict horse races and lottery numbers. Not at that level, no. But it's a more complicated question if we think of how our waking minds predict the future, right? I mean, I can predict what I'm going to be doing tomorrow with some accuracy, right? I've got my calendar. It tells me I've got a couple calls. I got to do a couple things. So prediction at that level is not really mysterious. It's what our minds do. Indeed, part of the glory of the human mind is our capacity to project beyond the here and now to an imagined future state, right? And because we do that so effortlessly and naturally and normally, we take for granted how unique that is in the animal kingdom and just how powerful a capacity that is of our mind. So at this level, I would say dreaming, what happens in dreaming is continuous with that, in the sense that when we go to sleep and our minds go through these cycles of activation, we continue to reflect on, mull over, ponder, stress about, you know, the different things that concern us during our waking lives. So that some dreams have relation to things that actually happen. And you could say there's some almost statistical inevitability to it. You know, you have 100 dreams of having a car crash. Well, one time the next day you have a car crash. Is that prophecy or is that just kind of law of averages? One of the most prominent theories in dream research today is referred to as a threat simulation theory. A researcher in Europe, Antti Ravansuo, who hypothesizes that the fact that dreaming has a tendency towards nightmares of being chased or attacked, often by wild animals, often by unknown males. Theory is that In the early ancestral environment, these were actual threats to human survival, especially when you're a little kid. Wild animals or marauding bands of, you know, the warriors from the tribe on the other side of the hill attacking. So over time, the idea is that because we continue thinking about things and imagining things in sleep, those people who had dreams that anticipated these kinds of threats, being chased or attacked, and took advantage of the powerful kind of reality simulating capacities of the dreaming mind to let you feel, what does it really feel like to be chased and to be pursued? Dreams of those, and I speak from personal experience, can be intensely realistic and generating all the physiological kind of responses that that situation would really elicit in waking life. And so the idea is that if you have more of those dreams, you're more likely to survive something like that if it actually happened in waking life, compared to someone who didn't have those kinds of dreams and thus did not have that kind of internal preparation and rehearsal for that kind of a survival threat. Sexual dreams have a similar function, particularly in early adolescence, of, shall we say, priming the system, of taking something that is preeminently survival related and in the imagination, anticipating, preparing for activities that will be of vital importance once they hopefully happen in the waking world, right? So there is always a saying, there's a lot of evidence that dreaming does anticipate the future, think about it, prepare us for the future, cast our wondering gaze towards the future. That's what dreaming does. Now, with that as kind of the empirical foundation, seven fat cows and seven thin cows, seven thin grains of corn, seven fat ears of a grain, that starts to get into greater specificity than we can, I would say, scientifically support. But, you know, the tendency of the dreaming mind to orient itself towards our future, I think, is the experiential seed of these kinds of stories.
We've talked now about the democratization of dream interpretation. Was there before that, I guess, a time when dream interpretation was used within religion primarily as a way to manipulate people's beliefs in order to control behavior? Is that a part of dream history?
Oh sure. Yeah. And I would never want to, you know, overly romanticize such things, because anything that can be a power for good can be a power for less good things and downright evil things. And so there's the potential for manipulating people with their dreams. I, to be honest, find it more worrisome, the idea that people should just kind of shut down their dreaming and you know, oh, that's only back in the time of the prophets were dreams acceptable, but now you can't do that. Or dreams, you never know if it's a demon or it's, you know, in Jewish context, if it's Lilith. You know, Lilith is the kind of great temptress of Jewish male dreams. You know, it might be a dream from Lilith. So just like put that all away. And to me, the worry is that dreaming is not just dreaming. It's the expression of this profound capacity we have to imagine, to think beyond our, like I said, beyond our current circumstances, to envision other possibilities, other worlds, other realities. And if you shut that down, you shut down a vital part of what makes people people, what makes them human. Now, if that's your goal, if you are trying to create a group of unimaginative, uncreative, compliant people, tell them not to pay attention to their dreams, tell them their dreams are nonsense, and better yet, sleep deprive them a little bit. Make them work so hard or do whatever you have to do so that they don't get steady, regular, sufficient sleep. And then you will have a very best shot at a compliant, population easy to tyrannize. That's like literally the effects of diminishing people's access to their dreaming minds and diminishing their sleep, is that you turn them effectively into compliant automatons.
Bringing this all together, does dream interpretation play a role in contemporary religious practices and studies?
Sufism in Islam, or tantric practices in Hinduism, certain mystical traditions in Christianity that are more open to these kinds of experiences. So yes, there are a lot of groups and indeed present day people, at least in American society, many of whom say they're nothing in particular, you know, in terms of religion and spirituality, they're very interested in dreams. So dreams in some ways, I think in the contemporary context, are offering people kind of an alternative, personalized way of entering into spiritual kinds of experiences, questions, dimensions of life that then lead them into other interesting things. So yeah, it plays an interesting role today, for sure.
Religion aside, Kelly, when I wake up tomorrow morning, what does science suggest I should make of my dreams?
I would offer my sort of shortest definition of dreaming, which is imaginative play in sleep. So dreaming is not just like play, it is play. It is a form of play when our bodies are detached from the waking world, when our minds are detached from external sensory stimuli. Our dreams are like a playground, like in a playground of the imagination. So when a dream crosses that threshold and lingers in waking awareness, I would just think of it in the first instance as, what game was I just playing? What did my mind just sort of playfully conjure up? I wouldn't rush to like, oh, what deep dark secret is this revealing? Or, you know, what is this? What, you know, who's going to die? You know, I wouldn't rush to that. Who knows? Maybe those dimensions are there too. But in the first instance, simply the gift of our minds playing, and like a finding shells on a seashore at low tide. Like, what is the high tide brought in during the night? I'll go out and just see, and maybe I'll find something beautiful. And
Kelly, thank you so much for joining. This was such an incredible opportunity for us.
Oh, I've enjoyed it a lot. Thank you.
Thank you both so much. I really appreciate your time, and Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
To you.
If you're looking to plug into more of Kelly's work, check out his website.
Sleepanddreamdatabase.org. That's an online open access archive of dream research materials, dreams, surveys, different ways you can explore the data, create, you know, some of these word search statistical comparisons I've been talking about. So yeah, and welcome for anybody to check it out and let me know what they think. To hold me tight
whenever I want you. The study is produced by Evan Scott Nicholas and me, Raviv Ullman. My co-host is Rabbi Adam Greenwald. Our guest today was Kelly Bulkley. Artwork by Julia Pott. If you have thoughts on Parsha Miketz or just want to tell us about your dreams, you can find us on Twitter at study_show. We would love to hear from you. We'll see you next week. I'm dreaming my life away.